Well, good day and welcome to another episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we have got a great episode here for you as we kick off our second recorded episode that we started doing here in 2019. It's been a good year so far, a couple of things going on, some big weather events, and we'll get into that with our meteorologist expert, Becky DePodwin, here coming up in a little bit. But first of all, we can't have a disaster podcast if we don't have our disaster co-host, Sam Bradley.
Hey there, Jamie. Well, yeah, I do want to talk to Becky because I'm freezing my butt off here in Colorado. We haven't gotten much snow this year yet. We were predicted up to 5 inches last night, and I think we got a quarter inch. Either that or it all blew away because the wind was terrible. So, Becky, what's going on? How much of the country is being affected by this storm?
A lot of the country. So definitely Colorado, although more the mountains in southern Colorado, the northern front range. Like you said, the wind kind of blew all their snow away. But basically snow from Colorado, Nebraska, Kansas, Iowa, up into Minneapolis, Minnesota. Ice for a lot of the northeast, mid-Atlantic tomorrow. We're expecting freezing rain here in Pennsylvania. Rain behind this that's going to fall on areas that have seen a lot of snow from the storm over the weekend. So that could cause a lot of flooding issues as snow melts really quickly. It's kind of just a mess right now across the country.
How cold is it back east, Jamie?
Oh, pretty darn cold. I'm not too far away from where Becky is. She's probably colder. She's a little bit farther north and higher in elevation than I am. But I think our low was 6 overnight. So that's cold enough for me.
Yeah, we're down to 9 tonight. So we're right there with you. Well, we have a great guest tonight who will be familiar to many of you that listen to this podcast and certainly in the EMS world. That's Wes Ogilby. And Wes, why don't you just give us a little bio on who you are and what you do?
Like Sam said, I'm Wes Ogilby. I'm a practicing attorney and paramedic here in Texas. Most of my attorney work has been in state government, has little, if anything, ever to do with EMS. Thank goodness. I am not the guy from the state who takes your license. There are a few people who have one to do, but that's another story. But I'm also an actively practicing paramedic, primarily volunteer. I've done worked in a variety of settings from urban to rural, primarily transport, some first response, and even some event medicine. And since Sam asked that, I do have a couple of disaster and MCI stories, because I guess we all do at some point in our career. My humorous introduction is that I am licensed by the state of Texas to both chase and drive an ambulance.
I love that. That's a great tagline for you. Well, you know, it is kind of unique because people seem to go one direction or the other, but to be interested in both, I can think of two people, Jim Page and Skip Kirkwood are the only ones that off the top of my head that do that. So which came first for you, the paramedic license or the law degree?
It's interesting. They kind of went almost parallel to the EMS behind it. Got licensed as an attorney back in 2002 after I graduated law school in 2001. About my second year of law school, I ended up doing a ride-along with Lubbock EMS out of just pure curiosity. I said, this is a lot more fun than being a lawyer, but I'm halfway through law school. It is a bad idea to change directions now. So I got involved online a little bit back in the day as Yahoo groups started following some of the EMS discussions. A friend of mine, once I moved back to Austin, said, well, I found an EMT class for you. I said, I can't do that. I'm working full-time. And she goes, it's at night for 3 months. And I said, So I signed up for it, got my EMT back in 2004. In 2006, ironically, the same person found a night paramedic class for me that lasted about a year and got my paramedic license in 2007. And been doing both and trying to maintain a balance between the two ever since.
Well, all it takes is motivation if you want to do it. And that's kind of the next thought in my head. I would assume there's advantages and disadvantages to having both sides of yourself. Can you respond to that?
You know, I honestly think that the two really do well with each other. I tell people, always say, well, EMS is stressful. And yes, it has its moments, but there are moments. The problem for me, one way or the other, as a paramedic is, and I hate to sound blunt, but it's no longer my problem after about an hour or so. It's someone else's problem. There aren't staff meetings. There aren't weeks of the problem festering around. I've had one case of an attorney that took over a year to resolve, and that's not uncommon. So it's a real nice change of pace for me, and it helps me put things in perspective. When at the office people say, you know, this project's an emergency. No, not breathing's an emergency.
Not in my book.
This is an inconvenience. This is an inconvenience. That's different. And being an attorney has helped me be a paramedic, I think. And I've always been a big believer in a liberal arts education. And I think, you know, law degree in some ways is the culmination of that. And you really get a good sense of critical thinking and just how to think and how to communicate with people, which I think are skills that a lot of paramedics are overlooking. And I think you see that some with the current EMS degree debate. Everyone's saying, well, you need all these science classes. You need to learn all these clinical skills. And yes, you do. And it makes sense, especially when you're a new paramedic, to learn these things. But if you're moving up through the ranks and or developing your career, those skills become a little less important. You have to learn how to deal with people. You have to learn how the political process works. You have to learn how to teach and motivate people. Those are things that I think having a different educational background has helped me with.
Well, I don't know what kind of law you do, but would you be prone to taking EMS cases, or do you kind of shy away from that?
Since I work for state government, it's not really like I get control over what cases I have.
That seems like it'd be a good match because there's very few lawyers that really understand what medics do.
Well, you know, I find in general, there's very few people that understand what medics do. I work in a state agency that regulates higher education. I work with people regularly who have doctorate degrees and who have no idea. And I think some of it's our fault that there's a difference between EMT and a paramedic.
Oh, yeah.
Or that they don't understand when an emergency happens at the office. Well, we called for an ambulance. Why are firemen here?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of, we have not done a really good job of explaining to the public what we do. We've told them to call 911, and that's about all they know.
Now, you know, that's something less that I've been harping on for years is that we really fall down on the job when it comes to giving our public realistic expectations of what to expect from us. And it's just something as simple as just being out forward-facing in the public at public events and things and going to Rotary Club meetings and speaking to the group about how local EMS works, how local fire response works, so that they can tell their neighbors, oh, yeah, I never knew this. And the word gets around that, oh, did you know your ambulances in this area are completely staffed by volunteers? And most people don't know that. So, this is something that I've long made a point of talking about and encouraging agencies to do, and it still doesn't get done.
Well, and Wes, as Jamie and I are both writers, it makes us both crazy to read a story that has an EMT in it starting an IV. Ah, do your homework if you're going to commit it to paper.
Well, and this probably dates me, but I'd say, I guess they're an intermediate, but now I have to say they're an advanced EMT.
Well, yeah, now we got that, so it's even more confusing. So, Becky, you got any thoughts or questions for Wes so far?
Just how are you surviving with everything you have going on? Seems like a lot of different things that you're trying to focus on, which is awesome. Just a lot to manage.
I've been really blessed and fortunate that I have an employer who's pretty good about understanding that, hey, sometimes I need to take a couple days off and knock out some continuing education or, you know, I may be out of the office for a week for a conference. I know Sam and Jamie and I have run into each other at some of the national conferences, and they understand that, you know, I'm going to take some annual vacation to go to those things and keep up my skills. And honestly, sometimes it's helped at the office. You know, we've had a couple of emergencies pop up in the workplace, and that's something that I've always been kind of interested in. Is there are a lot of people, I don't know if there's a lot, but there's a significant chunk of people out there who have an EMS certification and do something else full time. And emergencies happen in the office, and you know, we've had a stroke, we've had a couple seizures, we've had some chest pain, just the nature of working with an aging population. And I seem to get called in to pinch hit very quickly.
Well, Jamie, kind of on a related note, you know, where you're talking about people learning that they have volunteers in their area, do they kind of go with the assumption that volunteers are less educated or less capable? Do you get a sense of that?
I don't get it from here. I mean, I think maybe I run into that more frequently when I am at a conference talking to a paid paramedic. And, you know, I've had, you know, talk about where do you work, what do you do conversation. And when I tell them, well, I work in a volunteer service, I get the, oh, and I just kind of look at them and I'm like, well, you know, I'm a volunteer paramedic. I don't get paid to get my hours. I don't get paid to do any of the things that I do. But I'm still expected to maintain the same level of professionalism, even if my call volume isn't as high as yours is. So I think kudos to people like Wes and people do the things that we do in a volunteer system, because it does require a different type of commitment to, as Becky said, do all the things we do, where we have a full-time job during the day and or at night and go respond on calls when they're off time. So I think that it's a bigger challenge than a lot of people really give us credit for in many situations. But as far as our community goes, I think they accept it, especially I'm in a small rural area. So when I go out and see people, half the time I know them or know somebody who knows them. And, you know, it becomes real neighborly real fast.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And the East Coast is just ripe with volunteers. People from California are less likely to understand that because we have very few volunteer agencies out there. Anyway, I divert, but I just thought that would be an interesting question. And Wes, what's your thought on that?
My thought on what exactly? Because I was following the conversation, but to quote Sergeant Schultz, I was paying attention, but I lost track.
Well, no, I was talking about Wes. I was talking about, you know, the reaction of your both your public and other providers to the fact that you're a volunteer. And my experience versus your experience.
I could talk an hour on that, and I would probably be rather controversial. One of the things that we face in Texas is that our EMS certifications are the same, whether you're paid or volunteer. Obviously, I think that's the case in almost every state. It's not the case with firefighting certs. Firefighting certs in Texas for volunteers are completely voluntary. And to be a paid firefighter in Texas, you have to have a certification. And there's a lot of rivalry that has existed between volunteer and paid fire. And you see that sometimes rub off with the EMS stuff, not so much between EMS agencies, because everyone in EMS knows that theoretically we're held to the same standard. But you see a lot of fire departments not wanting volunteers even on the EMS side of the fire department because they say, well, you know, you aren't fire certified. Well, and that's fine. But they will have people who are getting their fire certification and don't want their EMS certification, but they won't do the same. They won't do the opposite. They will not allow people who are EMS motivated but not fire motivated to join.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I worked for a fire agency for 20 years that had paid on call and career, and many of them went from one to the other, but, you know, there was still that issue between them. But that's another podcast. So I understand when you started working the field, you had one of those pesky hurricanes sneak up on Texas, did you not?
Well, fortunately, it did not sneak up on Austin. Austin, we've gotten the brunt. Not even the brunt, but we've gotten some hurricanes that have moved in through our area, but mine was actually Katrina. We had, after Katrina, a lot of the evacuees were moved into Texas by civilian and military resources, and the Austin Convention Center was turned into a giant hurricane shelter, turned into a giant hurricane shelter for all those displaced by Katrina. And I was had been an EMT for less than a year. My fire chief from my volunteer fire department called me and said, we're sending people down to the convention center to help triage patients. Can you go? I called my boss, different boss at the time, and I said, hey, they're deploying us. And they said, you know, we understand. We've got enough coverage at the office. Go. So for the next 3 or 4 days, I was down at the convention center for 12-hour shifts. It was a really interesting experience. They told us to bring very minimal gear with us. And we went up and down the aisles of beds at the convention center, just stopping and talking to people and kind of doing the sick, not sick assessment. If we determined that they were sick or had something going on, we had prearranged hand signals. A wheelchair or stretcher team would come in, and the next thing we knew, those patients were getting moved out to the treatment area that was in a separate part of the convention center. We ended up seeing some very sick people. The one I remember vividly was a lady who had had open heart surgery less than a week before and was evacuated with no meds.
Ouch.
Needless to say, she got brought out.
Well, then you learn very quickly that disaster medicine is very different than your everyday medicine. In fact, your method of triage is very different as well. And that's something I hope our listeners are learning as we go along here. Right, Jamie?
Absolutely. And it's something that, you know, I like hearing, you know, the differences between the way he triaged people in that situation, because you didn't know what you were getting at all. You know, it's not like you got dispatched or something to a given call where you were expecting chest pain or expecting respiratory distress. You know, you really were going in blind and just kind of, you know, making eye contact with people and seeing what they, you know, just kind of listening to them, saying hello. And that's a different level of requirement. And that's not something you necessarily learn. I don't know about you, Wes, but I never learned that kind of conversational triage, so to speak.
And one of the big challenges we also had with that was the amount of rumors that were spreading even among the responders. Rumors like the one I remember vividly is the Air Force has a C-17 inbound with nothing but patients on vents. They're coming.
Somebody was very mean.
Needless to say, we did not see that. We don't know where they got diverted to. We don't even know if that plane existed.
It sounds like somebody wanted to stir it up.
I don't think so, because it was coming from someone on the response side. But I think the information was just moving so quickly that we didn't really get to it. One of the other challenges we found was and I'm going to be politically incorrect here, the Red Cross tried to assert themselves pretty heavily at the shelter. And they said, we're here, we're in charge of volunteer operations, you have to go through us. And I'm telling them, I'm here from the fire department, here's my ID, here's my badge, here's my credentials. Well, you know, you can't just show up. Well, I am showing up because the guy with the braid on his sleeves and the brass on his collars told me to be here. And finally he said, well, you have to sign in. I said, okay. So I walked towards their sign-in table, walked past it, and went back to where the medical area was and checked in, and they told me what to do. So it was really interesting seeing that organization kind of trying to take over the public safety response.
Yeah, I've seen that myself, but eventually that was during the 2007 fires in San Diego, but eventually we're able to, you know, create a good working relationship between them and the federal government. So yeah, sometimes it just takes... Go ahead, Jamie.
I was going to say, we've talked about this a lot, but things that happened at Katrina and soon after that, have vastly changed in the way that we're not as siloed in our response capabilities. There's much more coordination and communication between agencies and NGOs like the Red Cross. It's interesting that we hear that because it's not the first time we've heard about that type of challenge from coming out of Katrina and other disasters at that time frame. But
and it was interesting to follow up on, if I can follow up on that for a second, Jamie. We had a very similar incident happen in my fire district for Rita, which happened not long after Katrina. They opened up a special needs population shelter at a middle school in our fire district and didn't tell anyone. Whoa. They just kept dropping. They kept dropping calls. We had about 15 calls in 12 hours come from that shelter without them telling anyone. Finally, the guy who was the acting lieutenant that day coordinated, and I think it was with the transit authority, coordinated with them and said, "We're bringing a bus, and anyone who wants to go to the hospital, now is your chance to get on the bus and go. We're not coming back."
Wow. Well, like Jamie, go ahead, Les.
And that's sometimes what it took for the local government authorities and the Red Cross to get on the same page.
Well, on a wider scale and a larger scale, think back to the time before ICS when fire departments didn't even speak the same language or didn't train the same way, much less, being able to work with EMS and police. But because of the place our world has gone, it's a necessity. It's a safety issue. Would you agree, Jamie?
I do, and that's one of the advantages of the way that training has become much more integrated between across the fire service and EMS service in general, and then in the interagency interactions that we have with police and local resources, health departments, even the military. We've seen that change so much over the years, and it's really a training issue. And we talk about training all the time here on the show because we have the relationship we have with Paragon Medical Education Group that gives us the opportunity to talk with them about some of the specific disaster related experiential training that they provide. And I think that they actually spring out of an offshoot of the lessons learned at places like 9/11, at places and events like Katrina and others, that taking that experience and saying we can do better, and then modeling a new training program after that each time they encounter a new disaster, making changes, making updates. And so I just urge people to, reach out to them and thank them for their support of the show. You can find them at paragonmedicalgroup.com. You can also find them over at paragonmededu on Twitter. Just reach out to them. Ask them how they can customize a specific training program for you. And at the same time, say thanks for supporting the Disaster Podcast. And I know, Wes, you've talked a lot about just some of the things that have changed over the years, even for you and your time in the service, as you've looked at working in a so-called day job and then having an EMS career on the side.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Wes, is there a place that you're active online that maybe people can just kind of follow what's going on with you? I don't know if you're active on social media in any particular place you'd like to share.
I have Facebook. I post way too much on there.
I see you all the time.
Combination of EMS, law, sarcastic humor, food reviews, and a love of virtually all things Texas, especially barbecue.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds great.
And I have a blog that is very intermittent. I have to be hit by the muse and inspired. There will be weeks where I write two to three posts, and I've gone several months without a post just because nothing's really struck me. I've had ideas that have kind of percolated in my head, and they just don't flow onto paper, right, or onto electrons, right? But that blog is theambulancechaser.com. Believe it or not, someone had already taken ambulancechaser.com, which speaks volumes to the honor of my day profession.
You have the right to say that because you are one. I love your line. You can drive him and catch him.
Well, and I actually have a whole comedy line that I use in some of my when I present at some of the conferences. I remind people that I found out things I cannot do in the ambulance. I cannot staple a business card to a C collar for a car accident victim. I also have found out that I cannot put a sign on the ceiling of the ambulance at the head of the stretcher that says, if you can read this, you may be eligible for a cash settlement. And the final thing that I've learned is a really bad idea as a paramedic and an attorney is when the 12 lead prints out, never ask anyone if they've done estate planning.
Oh, jeez. Well, you're the Facebook king, and I think Becky's the Twitter queen. Right,
yeah.
Jamie?
Bex, you've been posting quite a bit of good stuff out there for, from a recent conference you went to and some of the weather events have been going on. If people are interested in weather, following some weather updates and things like that, you're definitely a good person to follow on Twitter. Where can they find that?
I am at WX_Bex, BECKS. I'm definitely posting a lot about winter weather right now, but hoping to be posting about warmer weather here in the coming months because I'm kind of over the cold.
Me too. You were at a conference recently, weren't you, Becky?
Yes, I was at the 99th annual American Meteorological Society annual conference, which I know we need to have a whole other conversation about.
Yeah, we do. So look forward to that, folks. We're going to be talking about things that Becky picked up there in a future episode. So stay tuned for that. And thanks for coming on tonight. I know we kind of grabbed you on short notice, but we appreciate it.
Yeah, no, all good. It's good to talk to you guys again.
Yeah, we missed you over the holiday.
Missed the whole gang.
Yep. Hey, Sam, where can we find you?
Well, the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. On our Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. Where are you, Podmedic?
Well, she said it, Podmedic, anywhere, most social media places you can find me there. So please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And of course, always at our Facebook group. So just search for Disaster Podcast in Facebook, join the group. We'd be happy to let you in and join the discussion over there. We have a whole lot of people as part of the group, and we talk about episodes. We talk about recent disaster events and things like that. And I was interested in getting Kyle on tonight. So he's on working the X Games right now. But we will be having him on in the future because I know we had two avalanche fatalities this past week. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find out if he had any, thing to share as far as thoughts from a ski patrol standpoint on how they respond to those types of events. Because that's quite, it's quite a, shuts down everything and brings a lot of people out to respond. But it's not a really safe place to be all the time. So you got a lot of things to keep in mind. So maybe we can actually have Kyle on to talk about managing avalanche response and rescue.
Yeah. And Dr. Joe's in London right now having a ball doing his CPR research thing with the folks in England. So we're going to put a slot together for him when he gets back. I'm sure he'll be excited to talk about that.
Great. Well, I think Wes has had a great example tonight of, differences between, just looking at how you triage differently in a disaster setting. But I know, Sam, you've had thoughts about that, too. We've talked about these types of things for the last, going on 6 years?
Yes, we have. We're in our sixth year now, we could proudly say. So I did enjoy having Wes with us, and hopefully we can do this again. Maybe he'll have a nice, juicy one out there that he can tell us about in Texas. Things are always bigger in Texas, But, his experience with the hurricane is another great example, Jamie, that disaster medicine's not our everyday medicine.